This morning, I'd like to share with you, first of all, a story. The story of moving from London to the Solomon Islands. And then we're going to use that story to help us think about ourselves as Christians, being people of the way, and to think about some of the choices that that involves for each one of us along the way, and some of the things we need to consider as we make those choices. So first, we're going to have the story, and then a bit later in the service, we'll come back to it and think about it further. It was in January 1972 that I set out from Heathrow Airport on a journey that was going to take me to the South Pacific on the other side of the world. People have often asked me, why did you choose to go to the Solomon Islands? Well, the simple answer is that I didn't. It wasn't my choice at all. I made an offer to the Missionary Society, and I chose to do that. And they chose where to send me. I didn't know anybody in the Solomons. In fact, I didn't know anything at all about the Solomons very much. And a bit more worryingly, I soon discovered that the Missionary Society didn't know anything about the Solomons very much either. The information that they gave me about Goldie College and where it was before I went turned out to be totally, totally wrong. And it was years later, after I'd come back, that I realised that that was because I was the first person they'd ever sent to the Solomon Islands. So they didn't know what they were talking about either. My permit to enter the Solomons arrived at the very last postal delivery before I left. I was just poised, ready to ring up and say, I'm going to have to cancel the ticket or alter the ticket because I haven't got the permit that I need. When the postman came on a foggy afternoon and delivered it. When I set off, I didn't know quite how long the journey was going to take, but I did know roughly where I was aiming to go to. Of course, it was exciting, but it was a bit frightening too. And apart from the natural fear of being a bit worried about the whole thing and how far I was going and how I was going to get there and so on, I had a couple of other things in the arrangements that worried me. One was that I'd been given an air ticket to a place called Honiara. Honiara was the capital of the Solomons, I knew that much. I also knew that I had to go to a place called Munda, and that Munda was hundreds of miles away from Honiara. So I didn't know how that was going to work out or why precisely they'd done that. Now, also it had been arranged that I was going to stop over with a missionary couple, who happened to come from Tottenham, in fact, in Singapore for a few days on the way. And they were supposed to meet me at the airport, and just in case anything went wrong with that arrangement, I was given their phone number. No address, no place to find them, just a phone number. I think if I'd been a more experienced traveller, I wouldn't perhaps have worried about that very much. But on the other hand, it occurred to me that I didn't have any currency for Singapore. I had no idea about finding a phone there, if necessary, and I didn't speak any Chinese either. So I was a little bit worried about the fact that I really hadn't got much information about the contact there. Anyway, finally, I set off. I was leaving friends and family behind for, I thought at that time, 3.5 years, although that changed. I set off equipped with one suitcase, one hand luggage bag, one ticket to the wrong place, and in my pocket, a telephone number in Singapore. It was a very long flight to Singapore with two stops on the way, and when I got there, I was very relieved to be met at the airport with no problems. I was well looked after by the people that I was staying with. The one thing which proved to be a problem for me was the fact that I had not foreseen the need to be able to use chopsticks. You wouldn't necessarily if you were going to the South Pacific, but they kept taking me out to places for meals, and they only provided chopsticks at all those meals. And on one occasion, in one of the largest hotels in Singapore and the smartest hotels, I was taken out with them to eat, and I was trying with my chopsticks, my very best, my chopsticks and a meatball. And the meatball at one point just shot up into the air, across the room, and rolled under somebody else's table. Very embarrassing. I thought, okay, it's important to have a sense of humour on our journeys, and particularly to have the kind of sense of humour where you can laugh at yourself when everybody else is anyway. After the stop at Singapore, I flew on to Port Moresby. That was in Papua New Guinea, and that was the headquarters of the United Church of Papua New Guinea and the Solomon Islands. I went into the office there for the first time, and the first question I was asked was, "Have you made your will?" And the answer was, "No." Nobody suggested this, nobody's talked about it. I said, "Oh, that's strictly against the rules. Missionaries aren't allowed to go without making a will first." And I discovered later that most copies of people's wills were kept in London, but nobody had even mentioned it to me. The second question was fairly predictable, really. The second thing they wanted to know was why I was carrying a ticket to the wrong place. "Why have you got a ticket to Honiara when you're travelling to Munda?" Well, I asked that question too, and I don't know, but they said that you'd sort it out when I got here. And the man didn't look terribly happy about that idea, but he took the ticket away, and it did eventually get sorted out. Now, from there, I was due to fly on to the Solomons, to Honiara, in fact. But all the flights to the Solomons were delayed anyway because of a cyclone. There was a cyclone which was sweeping down the east part of Papua New Guinea and the west part of the Solomons, exactly where I was going. So I was grounded in Port Moresby for a few days anyway, until the planes were able to fly through to the Solomons. So I spent those few days, each morning reporting to the church office, and they said, "Today, go this way, walk up the hill there, and you'll have a look at the National Parliament building." They sent me out to do something, find something, each day like that. And then I was told, finally, that the ticket was ready, and they'd run out of things for me to go and look at in Port Moresby, it not being a very big place. So they were going to send me northwards to Rabaul, not in the direction of the Solomons, actually, but northwards to Rabaul, because there were more United Church institutions there to find out about. Now, about that point, I met up with a group of volunteers who were from Australia, and two of them were going to teach at Goldie College. So I was quite relieved to find somebody else who was actually going that way and knew something about it. They were sent to Rabaul too, but they went on a different flight to me. So when I arrived at Rabaul Airport, which was a small concrete building, I got off the plane. As I walked into the building, I was immediately paged. So I went to find out what that was about, and the man said, "Your plane to Munda left this morning." I'd arrived in the afternoon after all that time of waiting. So there I was, rather stuck, but I managed to go with the volunteers who had planned to stay in the United Church rest house. And so we stayed there overnight, and we were to catch a plane the next morning. And that plane would go through Damunda, we thought. So early the next morning, while it was still dark, and while it was absolutely pouring with rain still, which it had been doing all night, we got up, ready to go to the airport, and we literally had to carry the suitcase through nearly 2 feet of water to get to the minibus to get to the airport. And the chances of a plane taking off in those conditions, I thought, were about zero. But we got to the airport, and just after 6 o'clock at first light, the plane did take off. And the plane took off and went to a small town called Kieta, which was still in Papua New Guinea, on the edge of Bougainville Island. When we got out, they said, well, this is as far as we're going, and we hope there'll be another plane sometime today that will take you on to Munda. Nobody seemed very sure. Well, the plane took off again, and the one or two airport staff who were there packed up everything and disappeared in a truck. Left to ourselves, we explored the airport building, which took about 2 minutes, and discovered that there was a small concrete shelter, a shelf behind which the people were doing their business, a tiny kiosk selling drinks and sweets, which they had locked up before they left, of course, and which never opened. And it took us literally about 2 minutes to look round the airport building. So then we looked outside to see if there was anything outside. And as we looked outside, there was the sea one side, basically, and the other side, there was a rough, unmade-up road which disappeared in both directions. There was no traffic of any kind going past, and there was nobody walking past. And we thought, what happens if the plane doesn't turn up later today? So we ended up waiting literally 5 or 6 hours until 2 o'clock in the afternoon, when we were very relieved to see a plane actually arriving. One of the church workers, and almost 2 hours later, we arrived at Munda on that plane. And one of the church workers who'd come to meet the two Australian volunteers, incidentally, unfortunately for me, met me too. Now, by this stage, I was getting used to everybody's opening remarks. It was a greeting for the Australian volunteers, and then they turned round and looked and said, "And who are you?" So I introduced myself, and it was clear that nobody had any clue what was happening beyond Port Moresby to me. Well, we'd landed at Munda International Airport, where all the passengers who were going to the Solomons officially had to disembark and enter the country. The airport building was an old corrugated iron hangar left over from the Second World War, and it had tiny sections for arrivals and departures, a tiny bit that was the customs, the post office, the local savings bank, and all those things, all in the same building. It must have been one of the most compact international airports anywhere in the world, I think. And the first general impression of Munda was that, again, there was really nothing there. So our fellow passengers who got back on the plane to go on to Honiara just looked at us and said, well, what are you supposed to be doing here? There's nothing here. And to say we were going to teach at a school looked very unconvincing, because there was no sign of a school there or anything like that. Well, we were taken to the mission station in a dilapidated Land Rover along a narrow, rough coral path, normally used as a pathway, that had been made during the Second World War. And the bishop and the mission staff had gathered there to welcome us with a cup of tea and speeches, to which we should have replied, but didn't. Anyway, as we entered the large room, one of the people who was there was the doctor, who was from Australia, and he looked at the three of us, and his opening sentence was, which one of you has been in Africa? So I confessed, that was me. Well, he said, I should keep quiet about that if I were you. People who've been in Africa are not very popular here. So that was my welcome. And I sat down on the only empty chair in the room, which was beside the doctor, and said very little. I certainly didn't make a speech, and it was only after I'd been in the Solomons for quite some time that I understood why the doctor's advice was quite useful, and that it was very bad manners not to reply to a welcome speech. But it had already happened. Now, Graham, a New Zealander who was the deputy head at Goldie College, had come over by canoe to meet us, and he brought his two small daughters, who were about 4 and 7, something like that. He spent the entire tea time telling us how terrible the canoe journey had been from Goldie College, how rough the sea was because of the cyclone, how they all thought they were going to be drowned, and how we couldn't possibly go back that way. In fact, everything we didn't want to hear just before we were going to make our first sea trip in a dugout canoe. Well, after a lot of discussion about how this was going to work and how we were going to travel safely across to Bunga Island, where Goldie College was, we were taken further down the road to a strip of really deserted beach. And finally, we set out in a very loaded dugout canoe with Margaret, Jan, the two volunteers, myself, Graham, his two children, the canoe driver, and our three big suitcases. And we went for about half an hour by canoe. And then, looking ahead again, we were still seeing nothing. Islands with trees, and that was it. Well, after a rather anxious half an hour like that, we arrived at a coastline with a very small wooden jetty jutting out from mud and mangrove. And that's about what was there. There was certainly no sign of any buildings or any habitation. The headmaster, Bob, was on the jetty to meet us. Still no sign of any school. So both he and Graham warned us to be very careful how we got onto the jetty from the canoe, because of all the rain, it was very wet and very slippery. So Graham picked up his smallest daughter and demonstrated how to get out safely. Holding his smallest daughter, he put one foot on the jetty, slipped backwards into the canoe and into the water, and at the same time literally threw his daughter onto the jetty. She landed half caught by the headmaster, reasonably safely, just had a nasty shock, and shouted and yelled about it considerably, but she was okay. The rest of us got out of the canoe very, very carefully and safely. And at this stage, we left the cases at the jetty because there was still no sign of anywhere where we were going, and certainly the three of us knew that we could not carry a heavy suitcase for miles. The headmaster said, "Oh, you just carry what you can carry, leave the suitcases, I'll send somebody to get them later." So we did. We left them on the beach, as it were. And we walked and walked and walked through rows and rows of coconut trees. And at last, some buildings came into sight. Well, I'd finally made it. It was the end of a journey halfway round the world and the start of a new adventure. It had taken about 2 weeks from London's Heathrow Airport to Goldie College and from jumbo jet to dugout canoe.